Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 52, Mrs. Wifflebottom's Pants.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you have tuned into This Week in Law. Welcome back to our 52nd show. We're here today with Ernie Svensson. Ernie, great to see you again.
Great to be here as always. Looking forward to it. It's a beautiful day here in New Orleans, and I hope it's beautiful where everybody else is too.
It is gorgeous here in California. Wonderful day for doing TWiL. Also with us today is Carl Sussman. Carl, great to have you on the show.
Hi, good morning. Great to be here. Yes, it is another horribly, horribly perfect day here in Southern California. Shouldn't say that, right? Not everyone has weather like we have.
Yeah, don't jinx it. We need a nice weekend here.
Right.
Yesterday, we had some sort of early March gale blow through late in the day, but it seems to have ceased its activity. So
One time when I really feel bad. I do not have a window in my actual office, so I can't see what's going on. People are coming in and out, and they're saying, oh, wow, have you seen it outside today? I'm thinking, no, because I'm sitting in here, but thanks for telling me. So, yeah, we hope we get this weather over the weekend.
Your office is in Santa Monica?
In Brentwood, right, just next to Santa Monica.
Great. For folks not familiar with Carl, he is the West Side Gadget Guy, writing about things technological and geeky, and has a new book out called Love Your Geek, which I just started, Carl. It's very entertaining.
Well, it's definitely not one that you have to take too long to read. It's a short read. If you've started it, then it's safe to say you'll probably finish it very soon. But yeah, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
You haven't seen my bedside table. It is littered with the things I have started and not finished, and so I keep picking them up and putting them back down again.
Time for an ebook for you, I think. We got to clean that up.
That's true. Is there a Kindle version?
Of course. And I'm actually happy to say that I'm trying really hard to get the iPad version available at launch. So I'm trying. Not sure it's going to happen yet, but I'm close.
Oh, wonderful. Well, if you have, this is a bit off topic for TWiL, but might be interesting for folks who are listening. Some friends of mine are trying to get a book on both the Kindle and the Sony ebook reader and, of course, the iPad. So if you have like quick and dirty how-tos for doing all that, tweet them out so people can see. I follow you on Twitter. Other people should too. Carl Wireless on
That's
Twitter.
That's actually not a bad idea. I can do a quick little video capture of how Kindle publishing is literally, it's like nothing. It's a piece of cake. So yeah, I can do that. And then if I can actually get that thing out on the iPad in some sooner than later, then I'll definitely give you all the information on that. There is really no system for it yet. It's really just a matter of begging and pleading and hoping you'll get to the right person fast enough. And I'm sure once they finally come out with the actual official procedure for iPad publishing, then it'll become easier.
Great. Well, we'll look for that. Also with us is Venkat Balasubramani. Venkat, welcome to the show.
Hi, Denise. Thank you.
Venkat is a blogger and writer and has a blog called spamnotes.com and a lawyer. And like all of us who love to come on and tune into this show, pays attention to issues in tech law. So thanks so much for joining us.
Great. I'm glad to be here. And it's actually a beautiful day in Seattle, shockingly enough. We have the weather here is much better than people think. I shouldn't let that secret out, but it's probably about 60 and sunny, which is great weather for Seattle.
It's gorgeous in Seattle. When it's gorgeous in Seattle, it's a beautiful, beautiful city. So we look forward to getting your insights on the show today. So we've got, it was hard to put together all the discussion points for this week because there's a lot going on, and I hope to make our way through most of what I'd flagged here to discuss. One thing I wanted to talk about real quick, since people probably have their census forms in front of them and are considering the implications of what they should do with them, is the 2010 U.S. Census, which has rolled around. And the reason I went ahead and put it on for the show is there's a video that no fewer than 10 people sent my way asking questions about on YouTube, called "The Census is Getting Personal." And it's by a guy, let me get his name. It's going to start playing here in a second. Let me pause it. It's by a guy named Jerry Day. And it's a little bit, you know, as I viewed it, and I'd love to get other people's opinions and opinions from the chat room about it. It's in our show notes, which you can check out at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/52 if you want to go and see Jerry's video. The reason I say it's a bit alarmist is I went and actually read the 10 census questions that are part of the census, and counter to what Jerry is sort of ranting on about here. And it kind of seems to me like maybe we should be going to Snopes and seeing if this thing has been debunked thoroughly or not. Jerry is complaining that the government is collecting far more information than it generally has in the past and or is authorized to constitutionally in the process of counting us. And specifically that it's after economic information, income-related information, where your income is being derived, that sort of thing. Now, I also put in the show note the actual link to these census questions, and I don't see anything in there about that. What I do see is some things that could be tenuously linked to economics, I suppose. It asks you whether everyone in your home lives there all the time, and if they don't, if they live elsewhere, and I suppose that's a way of getting at whether you have a second home. But, you know, as I go through this stuff and consider, you know, suppose the government is collecting some economic data here. We're talking about the United States government, the people to whom you supposedly pay your taxes, and also who are responsible for Social Security and thus have their fingers in your income data anyway. So I really don't see what the big deal is here, and just wanted to throw it out to the panel and see if you guys have any thoughts on this. Ernie, what do you think? Are you completing your census form, and do you have any trepidation about that?
I actually completed my form and I sent it in. It was very easy. I was actually kind of surprised. It kind of folded out into it was sort of like a 3-panel brochure, and I thought there were going to be a lot of questions, but really it was just specific questions about each person. You know, how long do they live there full time? And I think the reason why they asked that question is not just about the two houses, but also a lot of families, if you have kids who are of teenage age who live with both parents who are divorced and they go back and forth and you kind of have to sort out who they really live with, that's probably one reason for a question like that. But it was very easy. It was simple. You know, and I see on that YouTube link that you had, somebody said that Jerry was mistaken and talking about the long form. I'm not aware that there was a long form, and I don't know what the long form would ask, but maybe that is the problem. Maybe there's a long form that I don't know about.
Yeah, he also says something about now the census is actually asking for information from you on a yearly basis, as opposed to these large censuses that take place every 10 years. I don't know. I've never gotten anything other than the actual big ones. So who knows? Maybe certain people are being targeted in different ways. Venkat, do you have any concerns about the census or any thoughts about the constitutionality of the government gathering this sort of information?
Yeah, I think I checked out the video, and after about a minute or two, it kind of seemed like one of those alarmist videos, and I couldn't really get through the whole thing. And I have my form sitting in front of me, or sitting on the dining table. I haven't filled it out, but it looked fairly straightforward. And, you know, a lot of our information's out there anyway. I mean, I think the government is obviously authorized to collect information. And really, if you want to look at my Facebook profile or my Twitter feed, and I think this is a topic you'll get to later, I mean, there's a ton of information about me. It's pretty easy to figure out kind of the basic, you know, demographic information about anybody probably who's online. So I don't really have any concerns, and the video just seemed pretty overblown to me.
Right. Folks in the chat room, this is a great comment from Crucial Wax in the chat room, who says, I was told, and I'm not joking, by someone who went door to door with the census forms, if you aren't wearing pants when they call, you get the long form.
Well, then I'm glad to say I got the short form.
I have sort of capris on right now, so I don't know. It could be 50-50. But yeah,
I did have one.
Go ahead.
I did have one comment, which is, has there ever been a push to kind of do the census online? It seems like, you know, having to fill out a paper form is, I'm sure they'll move to it eventually, but I was somewhat surprised to just see a paper form. So I'm curious if anybody else has thoughts on that.
I think they're moving toward that. If you go to the Census 2010 website, I remember seeing something about that in their FAQ that they're working on an online form, but they're not doing it now. I'm sure that's because they don't want to leave people out. They want to be as inclusive as possible. It is indeed the law that you return the census form answered, or that you answer the questions. If you fail to return the form when someone actually knocks on your door, there are fines and penalties that can attach if you dig in your heels and, like Jerry Day, decide that this is just too darn much information to be giving the government. And my only thought about this, and people are saying, you know, the government doesn't have any right to know what race I am, et cetera, it's a little bit more nuanced than just counting us. But as a parent, I know that the statistical data they collect directly impacts funding for schools, for example. So I think it's pretty important that at least your school district gets an accurate representation of who's living where and how many kids and that kind of stuff. Carl, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I'm listening, and I have to say that I'm with MCAT on this for sure. You know, these days, for anyone to try and think they have any semblance of true privacy, they sort of got to get over it. You know, we're living in the online world, in the Google world, and I think, ironically, the people that are making the most noise about this, and again, it was funny, I was thinking the same thing, how alarmist can you get? You know, how sensational can you get? It's the census. This is nothing new. I bet some of the people that are having such an attack about this are... Again, you could Google their name and probably find out, like you were saying, their Facebook information, all sorts of other private information. They're tweeting and they're posting pictures on Flickr, and they're all over the place. I think, you know, you've got this. There's always this undertow, this group of people that are just so afraid of the government, you know, knowing this information. And again, they know. and they know because we're already providing them with this information. And it's like you said, when it comes to... drawing the lines and coming up with some of the budgets for schools, I think, ironically, those are some of the places where you're going to end up, you know, seeing some real disadvantage if people are not filling out these forms and letting people know. I mean, how many people are in your house? This is not something that is terribly private to begin with. It's not as if, you know, we're living in, you know, Soviet Russia, where everyone is afraid of everyone knowing something about them or what they're doing or the government tracking them down. I don't know. Maybe I'm too relaxed about it. None of it bothers me a bit. It just, I can't even see what the issue is.
Right. And some people have been nervous about there is, again, a discussion area on the census site about they're using GPS this year. And I guess that's a new thing since the prior decade censuses. And people are, you know, sensitive about that issue and wondering how that plays into the government's role. But again, I mean, I just have a really hard time getting scared or upset or paranoid about that one. Anybody can use GPS. You know, if someone wants to, whether they're a census taker or not. Yeah. If they're a census taker or not.
Every cell phone we're using has a GPS chip. And again, people are voluntarily running around using programs like Foursquare and Gwala and Twitter and all these other programs now that are getting big on geolocation. And again, everyone's volunteering. They're jumping to let everyone know whether they're at McDonald's or Carl's Jr. You know, that's important, but don't let the government know. I don't see where it's coming from.
Right. I guess the distinction would be, you know, for people who choose to use Foursquare and put that kind of information out there, it's one thing. And for others who are much more private, they're sensitive about some census taker standing outside their house and logging their address into some master system. But anybody can stand outside your house with a GPS tracking device and log your address into a massive system. They can be from the government or not. There's nothing illegal about that. So I don't know why the government would be any more subject to criticism on that front than something the rest of us could all do if we chose to do it. So,
for sure, Google drives around taking pictures and videos and logging the GPS location and the addresses. They could have a picture of you, you know, standing there in there at the same time in the picture, you know, but it's not the government.
That's right. That's right. So I don't know. I put this in the show notes because lots and lots of people kept asking me about it. And I got the impression that it was people who hadn't really taken the time to read through the census stuff and figure out exactly what was there and took it at face value. So I guess as sort of a public service announcement, I wanted to encourage people not to take things like this at face value and push back a little bit. And I don't know, I haven't checked Snopes. There might be something there about it. I don't know if it rises to the level of urban legend, but if we can do a bit of debunking or encouraging people to just be open-minded and not knee-jerk reactionary about this, then that's a good thing. But along the lines of the government gathering information, now, if you really want to see what's going on, the EFF has been looking into that and going to exactly what you and Venkat were talking about, Carl, how the government does gather information about us from things like Facebook and other social networks. And the EFF has Freedom of Information Act things pending where they've been gathering documents, and now they have posted a bunch of documents detailing law enforcement collection of this data. So if you want to see how the IRS and various other government agencies are tracking you, there's a very interesting guide to how someone working for the government might go about harvesting data off of these kinds of sites. Venkat, did you take a look at this? And does this give you any more pause about what you might put on your social networking sites?
I did take a look at it, and it gives me some pause, but I still struggle. To me, I think there's two sides to the issue. One is, you know, there's sort of the rules in the criminal context or in the investigation context that say, you know, the government has to satisfy certain standards before it obtains information about you to use to prosecute you. And it can't surreptitiously friend you or lie. And I don't know exactly what the rules are, but I know there are rules out there. The flip side is, you know, if people are sharing information, I mean, every week we see a story about a fugitive who is posting Facebook information, you know, drinking pina coladas in Mexico, and the authorities pick him or her up. And I think it's tough for me to have sympathy for that type of a person who gets caught as a result of sharing information. I think there's a lot of gray area as to, you know, is the government going to use it to surveil protest organizations? How far is the government really going to go? You know, I'm kind of on the middle ground on it, but it's a tough issue, definitely. And it was an eye-opener, I think, the EFF documents that showed, you know, everyone from the FBI to the IRS is gathering information. And for me personally, I think you just got to be careful about what you share. And I think assuming anything you share out there on the internet is going to end up in the wrong hands is probably the best policy. So that's kind of my thought on the EFF document. But I thought it was very helpful, and I think it's great that the EFF got the information and put it out there.
Yes, they definitely are not dropping the ball on that front. There, and by the way, this week is no exception as far as someone, some culprit getting caught by their activities on Facebook. Another of our stories to chat about this week involves an Italian mafia boss who was captured by the Italian police over his use of Facebook. Actually, managed to disclose enough about himself and his activities to go ahead and lead to an arrest. So I guess that's Mafia Wars gone, not virtual, but reality. Yeah, I think it's super interesting what's going on with social networking and law enforcement and the divides between people's private lives and personal lives and how these tools all mesh with that. Carl, you had a funny story that I thought it would be cool to share with our listeners about among the many things that you do is sell insurance. And part of that, I guess, plays into your life on Facebook. What happened to you there?
Oh, all right. Boy, for a minute I was thinking, wow, she didn't mention this. What story is it that I'm... Oh, yes.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I wasn't alluding to the fact that you had been apprehended.
Okay.
Although
yeah, I was wondering
share that
about
with
this
too.
Yeah. Well, here, this is what happened. Again, I by day, I am an insurance agent, and I do try and keep a pretty nice accessibility online with the different social networks like Twitter and Facebook and all the rest. And what happened was, it was a few weeks ago, and I have my iPhone and I have alerts, so certain things will pop up, you know, regardless of the time of day. And it was late, I want to say on a Saturday evening at some point, maybe 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, something like that. And a message popped up from one of my Facebook friends, which happened to be a client. And he said, just want to let you know that, you know, I did exchange that car for the new car and I want to be sure it's covered and let me know if there's anything else I need to know. And on the surface, just so you know, that's not enough information for me to insure something just by being told I got a new car. You know, we need things like the type of car, the year, the make, the model, the VIN, things like that. And it gave me pause because I stopped and I thought to myself, well, I suppose legally he's put me on notice that he does have a new vehicle. If I respond to this, am I in essence going to be affording him coverage by acknowledging his message? Should I be saying, well, you know, it's Saturday night at, you know, 10 o'clock. I really can't get to a computer to facilitate this change, or what exactly should I do? As it turns out, I shot him a message back very, very honestly. And I said, wow, you know, it's late. I don't have a way of getting to a computer to do this, but keep this email, you know, as some type of verification. We've been in touch. If there's a claim, I'll make sure it's covered. And, you know, email me the following information so I can get it taken care of. But I thought of you, Denise. I thought, ooh, this is something that I'm sure she would get a kick out of hearing about and seeing if it's something. Again, I'm the one non-attorney here. What is your take? I mean, what do you three think? Do you think that, you know, a Facebook message, I mean, where does it stop? How about a tweet? What if one simple tweet goes out that says, Carl bought a new car, thanks. Is that affording coverage? Is that giving me notification enough to be insuring something?
Yeah, well, not being an insurance lawyer and purely speculating and thinking that this is just kind of a funny hypothetical, I do think that something more would be required, that as far as, you know, a notice standard goes, we're not quite there yet. It doesn't feel like we're quite where we may ultimately be one day, where something like that would be adequate notice to somebody in order to trigger a legal obligation, in this case to make an insurance company bound to insure you. But, you know, I think it's real interesting to think about, because obviously your client thought that there was something significant in their advising you in that way, that they had bought a new car. Certainly in the past, when I've had that fun day when you're at the car lot and you've bit the bullet and gotten your financing and you're driving off in your new car, I pick up the phone and call my good friend who does all our insurance. And if he's not there, I leave him a message. And that's certainly, you know, in my mind, enough notice. So I think it's an interesting issue. I think that maybe the difference is these sort of continuous partial attention kind of formats, where the expectation would not be that you're going to pick up absolutely everything that comes through your Twitter stream, because it's just not humanly possible to do that, or your Facebook stream or what have you. And so, you know, that wouldn't be enough notice. But on the flip side, you would be reasonably expected to pick up your voicemail.
Email.
Yeah.
What do you think, Venkat? I was thinking. Is it, where do you draw the line? Is it voicemail? Is it email? Is it a tweet? Is it a Facebook? You know, and again, it comes down, a lot of it for in my industry anyway, it comes down to competition. Is I want to be accessible. I want to be out there. I want to be where people are so they can, you know, communicate easier and get information, you know, up and back. So I looked at it as something to embrace. And I'm telling people, you know, new clients, you know what? You can reach us on instant message. You can reach us on email. You can reach us on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're in all these places. And, you know, we're using it as a, I think the de facto standard still is email. If somebody emails me, that's more official. That's sort of in the process. Everything else is, there's email and there's all else. But I think you're right. I think at some point, inevitably, we'll get to a place where it might not just be a matter of email or voicemail, that it might be one of these networks. Who knows? We might be able to have a system someday, the privacy people will love this, where I might get a notification if one of my clients' GPS on their phone says they're at a new car dealership. And I would say, oh, Joe Schmo, are you buying a new car? I see you there. where do we go with all this?
Yeah, that is frightening. Venkat, what do you think? Do you think that maybe folks like Carl need a new disclaimer in their lives?
I think we all have enough disclaimers to go around. I'm not sure another disclaimer. We need another disclaimer, but I agree with you both. I think that email as a form of notice has just become acceptable over the past 5 or 10 years, whatever. And in the old days, I imagine people would say, hey, don't send me an email, send me a paper letter so I have a record of it. And now I look at people who send me a paper letter and say, why are you sending me a paper letter? Just send me the email. So maybe in 5 years, we'll get to a point where Facebook notifications become acceptable. I don't think they're acceptable at this point. I mean, for me personally, I'm a bad Facebooker, so I probably read about 10% of my messages, and the other 90% are just, crazy notifications of people. Somebody puts up a picture, I get a notification. I still haven't really figured out the Facebook notice procedure. So for me, Facebook isn't not particularly reliable, but maybe it'll become acceptable in the future. And I think Carl makes a good point about the customer service issue, which is, we all want to be accessible and want people to contact us through several different types of channels of communication. So as we go in that direction, the customers and I think the legal system is going to potentially develop a perspective that if you're going to make yourself available and allow people to contact you, and they do contact you, you got to do something about it. So,
Ernie, you haven't weighed in on this yet. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I guess my first question is more a practical question. Let me say first, I don't think that people are going to be asking for insurance, or they shouldn't be asking for insurance on Twitter. I mean, you only get 140 characters. It's public. I don't think that's really something that people want to do. And I think that there would be problems. But I am interested in the idea that if somebody is a friend of Carl's on Facebook, that they could send him a message and say, hey, I bought a new car, or by email, which would be better, say, hey, I bought a new car. And then I guess whatever information they need to give him, which would be the VIN number, the make and model, and I don't know what else. But assuming that they gave him all that information, I don't know, as a practical matter, and I'd like to hear from Carl, is that possible to get insurance? I mean, like, if he were there and he did have access to his computer, could he just then take that information and turn over and create a policy, or does he need to ask questions? Does he need to have that? I mean, what are the requirements? What do they tell him the requirements are?
Well, it's interesting, is it's company specific. Some companies will require more information than others. Some will require a signature. Some require a wet signature. It depends. But for a rule of thumb for an existing client, meaning somebody that we already have an established relationship with, if there's a change to the policy, it doesn't have to be a new car. Let's just say that someone's son is home from college. I actually am working on one of those right now. Client says, oh, my son's coming home from college for a few weeks. We need to add him onto the policy. I need very little to do that other than, his name, date of birth, and driver's license number. I can certainly afford coverage and do everything I need to do on my end with those two or three pieces of information. The question just becomes, do I then respond in Facebook? Do I respond in kind and say, well, they sent me a message on Facebook. I'll send them a message back and say, okay, I can do that. Here's the information I need. Or do I try and sort of force back into the normal channels that we're at least more used to now, like email, or even just say, you know what, we have to talk about this. Give me a call. I don't think it's so much of an issue as far as the insurers are concerned. As long as we're following our procedures, we're gathering the right information and we're giving it, providing it to them the way they want it, them meaning the insurance companies, I don't think they're going to care terribly much how we go about gathering it, as long as we're getting what they're requiring for those changes.
Right. Well, then I would say that you definitely don't want to respond on Facebook or anything that's public, just because even though the client may be giving you tacit permission by asking the question in that forum to begin with, you just don't want to, you know, you don't want to have that conversation in public. I mean, it's about a financial transaction. Maybe later they changed their mind. Maybe it wasn't really the client who sent the message, but somebody who got on the computer, or that's what they claim later. I mean, email, you know, would be the way to go. And so I would, you know, if somebody was asking me, should I respond on Facebook, I would say, nah, I don't think that's a good idea.
No, that's, I agree. And what, again, we respond, and not to make this about my office procedures, but as a general rule, that's what we're doing, is we're responding in the method and saying, okay, let's talk about it. You know, here's the phone number to call, or where can I reach you? We need more information. But I think what's interesting about it is, again, you know, where we started from in this part of the discussion, people are actually expecting that. They're reaching out. I have clients that will point blank say, you know, when I give them the office phone number and fax and hours and email and whatnot, they'll say, okay, and where else can we find you? It always gives me pause. I'm thinking, where else can you find me? I mean, how much more do you need? You have my phone number, my email address. But they're expecting an instant message now, for sure. They're asking, which, you know, are you on AOL? You know, are you on MSN? Where are you? And on Facebook, they seem to find me. You know, they'll do a search for Sussman Insurance, and I'll all of a sudden be getting these notices. So-and-so has added you as a friend. Please confirm. And I don't know who these people are. I have to go to the computer and look and say, oh, that's a client that someone in here, you know, wrote a policy for. Okay, we'll add them on. So I agree. We do have the issue to be concerned about. Everybody does, with people impersonating other people, or people changing their mind, or things being public or private. But I think for the time being, the sort of de facto standard is, if you get the message, respond and try and, you know, get with them in some more private or some way, some other way where you can confirm that they actually are who they are, and sort of go from there.
Can I pick up on something you just said that made me go, whoa, really? Your clients are asking you for instant message accounts? I haven't sent an instant message or received one in, I don't know, 5 years, maybe?
Really?
Yeah, well, folks are still IMing.
Oh, customers. Well, you know what? It started out, people, they're asking for instant messenger names. And if not, they're going on to the webpage and they're trying to do an online chat, you know, on the webpage. We go back and forth between turning that on or off, where all of a sudden I'll get, you know, messages popping up. They're trying to chat from our, you know, homepage. And or they'll just send me an email. I have a question. What's your instant message name? Are you on or what's your AOL? That seems to be what most people say. What's your AOL address? And wow. I know that normally means they want to send me an instant message. And again, I have the same issue with that. How do I know that, you know, Lucy loves dancing at AOL.com, you know, is really this client, you know, that they claim to be? I have no way of knowing. And I certainly don't want to go about verifying information about them, or are asking them information that's private and privileged without knowing who they are. Maybe I should be saying, well, here's my Skype name so we can video chat, so I can at least have you here and I can see that it's you. I don't know. These are going to be issues going forward. There's no question about it. Lucky us, we get to talk about it and worry about it in advance. Well, what do you think? Is that if I have someone and I can look at them and see them and I'm hearing from them, that would seem to me, that's as good as it gets, other than, you know, meeting them in person, wouldn't you think?
Yep, works for me.
Yeah, I think so.
So it's the issue of seeing them versus, I mean, I'll talk to them on the phone. I don't see them. And I'm playing devil's advocate now. Everyone agrees that, you know, it's great to see someone and know that it's them. Phone is just as good. Yes? No?
Yeah.
Yeah, I certainly think phone is an accepted notice mechanism in this day and age. I'm still just kind of boggling over the fact that you have a lot of people who IM you. I guess that that technology has been replaced in my life by so many other tools at this point. And I'm just wondering sort of how that curve skews. Venkat and Ernie, Venkat, start with you. Do you use IM technology anymore, or has that gone away for you?
I use IM a ton. And I think, you know, I have a ton of clients who are on IM, and they love being able to just IM me and say, hey, I got a quick question. What's the answer?
And don't send me a bill for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't necessarily bill, but I think it's convenient, and you know, you got to make some of the calls as to, do you want to switch it to email? Do I want to keep a record of what I'm sending? You know, lawyers have the classic CYA email that says, here's my advice, but here's the downside, here's the risk, and you want to put something like that in an email. And the other downside is obviously when you're not on IM, people sometimes hassle you and say, hey, I didn't see you on IM for the past couple of days. Where you been? So I use IM a lot, and I've continued to use it, and I find it's very helpful.
Ernie, what about you? Do you IM with folks, or do you at them on Twitter?
I use Twitter probably a lot more. I'm not a big direct message fan, and I try to avoid text messaging on my phone because I have trouble reading without my glasses. But I do use IM if you count Google Chat, because, and I'm usually not the initiator, but you know, most people, you know, who use Google and I'm in their contacts list, they can see me, and then they'll ping me, and I'll get a quick message, and I'll trade IMs with them. And I also noticed that in the tech place where I work, filled with techies and entrepreneurs, they use IM a lot. So I don't think IM is dead. I think it has shifted over to some other stuff, but I think for a lot of people, it's still a go-to resource.
Yeah, as you say that, I realize that for me, it has shifted to GChat, which is attached to my email. And from time to time, if I have Facebook open, their IM functionality will kick in if someone pings me there. So
you're saying that you don't instant message, but you'll get a message and you'll get a Google Talk or a Google Chat, and that's instant messaging for me.
I guess it is. I don't think of it that way. I think of it as an extension of whatever platform I'm working in, then, like Gmail or Facebook or what have you. So I guess that's the distinction, and it goes along with what we were saying before about the increasing pervasiveness of social networking tools in people's lives. Mashable had an interesting statistical study they cited from PR firm Burson Marsteller, studying the 100 largest companies in the Fortune 500 list, and found that globally, 79% of them use Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or corporate blogs to communicate with customers and other stakeholders. So this is actual official corporate sites. I thought that was pretty amazing. 86% in the U.S., 88% in Europe. Asia Pacific, precipitous drop to 50% of those global companies using at least one social media platform. I think that begins to say a lot about where that functionality goes. It goes to what you were saying before, Carl, about it's being integrated so seamlessly with your business. I guess you're not alone.
No, for sure. And what's interesting about the instant message, not to beat a dead horse on it, it's gotten to the point where, I shouldn't say it's gotten, it's been at the point where we have people that want it, that will AOL, you know, instant message, they'll AIM, they'll be on MSN, they'll be on Live, they'll be on Yahoo. So we literally have, you know, the company name on all of those different platforms. And I have one program that's always running that's logged into all of those locations. I'll toss this one out to you as well. What happens when, here I am, Sunday morning, I'm not at the office, I hope, and, you know, my message, the away message is set on the instant message, and people start sending messages. I just had a car accident. Help. What do I do? You know, am I almost doing them a disservice because they see that online presence? They assume that I'm there and that I'm accessible, and I'm not. You know, they're you know, do I have to start setting up away and forwarding messages for instant messages on all of these different platforms for that? You know, it's an entirely new and uncharted area because there's no norm. You know, people will ask, and I've had messages flashing on my screen when I come in Monday morning, and I'll grab the phone and I'll give them a call. Oh my gosh, you know, what happened? I wasn't at the computer. People seem to be pretty understanding. I mean, they realize that although I might have, you know, be showing online or away, that I'm not necessarily consciously sitting there monitoring those messages. And back to, you know, competition. Maybe at some point it'll turn into the thing, it'll turn into the fact that I have to have some type of a forwarding set up to someone in my office that's basically on call 24/7 if someone's going to send, you know, an instant message or a Facebook or a GTalk or, you know, something like that for claims. Maybe it's just an issue for claims or, again, you know, quotes, new business, whatever it might be, just a matter of competition. I'm sure there will be companies that will have a, you know, online presence for that all the time.
So here we have a discussion going on about how prevalent social media is becoming, not just for individuals, but for the hugest companies globally. And I want to make our tip of the week this week a post from Matthew Ingram at GigaOm, just to throw a wrench in all that, why social media policies don't work. And Matthew goes through and details the policy that Thomson Reuters put out for its journalists, guidelines for staff that go ahead and just try to scare the pants off them. Hey, maybe they'll get the long form for the census. As far as the risks involved in them using social media. And he goes on to use that as an example of, you know, listen, you're going to have to just let people exercise common sense. And if they're so clueless that they can't do that, you need better employees anyway. These scare tactic kind of policies just don't work. And they're going to wind up just getting you in a load of publicity trouble when they become public. Ernie, did you check this out? And do you agree or disagree with Matthew?
Oh, I totally agree. I did check it out. I love the quote, and I highlighted it. Said, talked about all the flaws and said, all these flaws boil down to one thing, a desire to control something that fundamentally can't be controlled and a fear of what happens when that control is lost. And I think that it really zeroes in on the problem. And it, you know, it's, I guess the way I approach things, you know, is I try to segregate the fact that I'm interested in technology. I may be more receptive to using it. I understand all that, but that's not the reason that I, you know, use to back up how I would advise somebody. What I do is you look at this and it's just an overwhelming technology that's there for people to use. Everybody's using it. The whole point of it is that it's easy for people to connect quickly with one another. It's kind of built on the whole premise of the way the internet works, which is packet switched network that routes around damage. And security and control is perceived as damage in a system like that. And so if you try to exert control, and usually you're just doing it because you think something bad might happen and you can list a bunch of things that did happen that were bad, and then you say, well, more bad things might happen, so we have to really nip this in the bud. Well, you're not going to nip it in the bud. You're just going to tell people not to do something that they're probably going to do anyway, or they're going to do it thinking that they understand how to do it, and you're Miss Thistlebottom finger pointing kind of, you know, rule instruction doesn't make sense to them, or they don't see how it applies. But in the end, there's going to be damage, and the damage is going to be there because people are going to talk to each other. So rather than try to tell people not to do it, they should try to figure out how to get all of the benefit out of this tool that they can. And then at the same time, of course, educate people like the IRS does that, you know, you shouldn't do social networking on our computers. However, you should, you know, search for taxpayers who are using social networks. But I mean, the information's out there. You can't control it. That's, you know, it's like my favorite Zen quote is this one. It says, if you want to control a cow, you must give it a bigger pasture. And, you know, it hardly makes sense to me, but I know that that code would not make any sense. Yeah, exactly. I know it would make no sense to anybody who's trying to control the stuff. But I think the point of that quote is you can't control the cow. So why don't you let him do what he wants to do and just be happy with that?
Well, way, way back in the early dawn of social media days, Ernie, when you and I and Dennis Kennedy and Tom Mile used to chew over these issues because we would see lawyers trying to create basically full employment acts for themselves in trying to scare people with the fact that their employees were going to be using social media. The message that we tried to get across then was, you know, do you have a whole lot of control or concern about your employees' use of the telephone, for example, because it's just as dangerous, and yet, you know, you don't need to necessarily bind them up in layer after layer of red tape. And if you do that, you're going to find that your business just comes to a standstill anyway. Do you still feel that way? And does that come in with this discussion?
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's exactly the point, is that you can't, whenever you see somebody talking about control, like, of these things, you're right. They don't talk about cell phones. It's just like when people say email is insecure or Twitter's insecure, and we have to really, really stop people from doing this. And I can tell you at least twice I've been in an airport and I've overheard a cell phone conversation. You know, no special technology, just standing next to the person who's blabbering, and they were saying things that they shouldn't have been saying. And in one case, it was actually an opposing counsel who just didn't know who I was, who didn't know what I looked like, and was talking about the case that I was involved in. You know, I mean, do we need a policy to tell people not to do that? I mean, apparently
we need
so.
A policy to tell people not to be idiots.
Exactly. That's there you go. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that reminds me of when you're in the hospital and you see the sign on in the elevator that says, doctors, please, you know, respect patient confidentiality. And you're thinking, yeah, you can imagine they could be in the elevator talking. Yeah, yeah, John, this guy back there, boy, man, he's going to go painfully in the next hour. And, you know, his mother could be standing there next to him. But on this topic, I want to ask a question, because this is an interesting and near and dear to my heart issue. When we're talking about security in a business, we're talking now more specifically about use of social networks in the business. And what my question is, is the main concern that we don't want social networks? Is it that we don't want them potentially leaking out confidential information on social networks? Or is it what really concerns me? Are we concerned that engaging in that type of online behavior is going to actually put the local intranet, the local office network, at risk? Because again, you're clicking on links, you could be picking up malware, you could be doing things that actually can affect the security in the actual office that you're working in. What is everyone's main concern on this?
Let me toss that to Venkat. Venkat, what do you think?
I think, first, I definitely agree with the way Ernie and you, Denise, described it. I'm not a big fan of the policies, and I think they're overwrought, and not typically the ones I've read are not very useful or user-friendly. I think the main concerns off the top of my head are probably three. I think the one Carl identified is a good one and a very valid one, which is, you know, when you're interacting on a social network, you know, there's security risk there. You could click on a link, infect a virus. You know, a lot of bad things can happen that are less likely to happen if you're just kind of doing your job, you know, sending out email, what have you. I think the other two concerns are, you know, an employee could interact in a way that, you know, maybe posts some sort of improper message, you know, makes a slur or whatever, and there's liability issues that come with that. You know, will the company be held responsible for what the employee says if the employee says something bad? And then I think the third concern is just that when the employee interacts, the employee is a representative of the company, and if he or she says something bad, it's going to reflect poorly on the company. You know, off the top of my head, those are the three things that come to mind, but I think they're best addressed by just good training and common sense education and letting people know, hey, here are some pitfalls, act responsibly, do the right thing. And I think mistakes will happen. You know, I think one of the links you posted, Denise, was a tweet from one of the engineers at Twitter that was saying, hey, we got all these great features. You know, it's going to be great when the rest of the world has these features. And he, I think, discontinued his blog as a result of the uproar over that. So I think even at a company like Twitter, where I think presumably the people are in tune with the tools and know how to use them, I think when it's all about being spontaneous when you're online and when you're interacting. And in these situations, there's always going to be some fallout. And I think the key is just educating people and I think managing it when there is a fallout.
Yeah, just to give the background on that, it came about in advance of, I believe, a conference that Twitter was going to host and announce some new features of their service that might actually cannibalize some of the business of third-party developers and, you know, make it so that some of those developers' activities wouldn't be quite so relevant because Twitter was going to perhaps begin doing that stuff itself. It does say that Alex Payne, the name of the engineer, was going to shut down his personal blog after he made this sort of off-the-cuff tweet about, it was sort of stay tuned, you know, we're going to have some stuff for you that's really exciting. Nothing too outrageous there, but he deleted the tweet and, you know, it stepped on some toes and
yeah, he'll be at monster.com looking for work anytime we can do this. You know, another case that I just thought of that where this happened, it wasn't that long ago. There is someone in the Israeli army that sent out a Facebook or a tweet that said something along the lines of, you know, we're moving into so-and-so to clean up tomorrow and then we should be home in the next 2 days. And apparently that was giving notice to some raid they were planning. And there was a big uproar and he was put in jail for a week or some such thing. And again, it was, you know, it seems like a harmless enough thing when you're saying, oh, yeah, tomorrow we're just going to go and, I don't know, round up some bad guys and then we'll be home for dinner next week or, you know, in 2 days. But it turned out to be, you know, some type of secret mission that they were planning that they inevitably were not able to follow through on.
Yeah. When you're in the military, you've got heightened obligations not to be an idiot in various ways, I think.
And one thing to add as well is my theory is that I think everybody's going to have a social media gaffe at some point in their life or their career. I mean, it's kind of like email. I mean, we've all sent the stray email that ends up in the wrong hands. I have, at least. And it happens. I think it'll happen probably to everybody. And that's not a reason to say, okay, we're not going to use these tools. I think you just have to maintain the common sense about it.
Yeah. And I'm particularly concerned with how companies go about conveying that message. And I think that Matthew's article is a great tip. If you are someone who is involved in that process or know someone who is, send along the link to this piece, Social Media Policies Don't Work, because I think it deserves thought and consideration as the policies are being drafted and considered. So right now I want to take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Audible.com, without whom this show wouldn't be nowhere near as fun and exciting. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you can sign yourself up for a free book, and thereafter you'll be enrolled in the Audible Listener Program. After our break here, we have a story to get to about Grisham finally going ahead and putting his books out as ebooks. So I wanted to go ahead and feature one of John Grisham's lesser known works that is available on Audible that is called Ford County Stories. And this would ordinarily be a $28 purchase. It's something like 8 hours and 42 minutes of wonderful short story, audio entertainment by, and this is from the early part of Grisham's career, so close to when he wrote A Time to Kill, and looks like a really fun one. I'm putting it in my queue because I am one of the Audible Gold listeners, and that gets me a credit each month for a new audiobook. That's what you'll get if you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill. In addition to your free book for just $14.95, you'll get a credit each month. And you can cancel it at any time. It's obligation-free. There are over 60,000 titles on audible.com to choose from. And I know, Carl, you were reading something on Audible that you wanted to recommend as well.
Yeah, I did. I'm a big Audible fan. And I can actually say I was an Audible fan before it became a big thing and everybody seems to know about it. But recently, I'd heard about a book called Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. And it's not one of those gross out books about, you read this and become a vegetarian. It's really just a story, a little bit of a reality check with regard to how factory farming actually works today. And it's an amazing, he reads it himself, which I love. There's nothing like hearing a book by the author. It really does make a difference. And I think it was 8 or 10 hours. It's a long one. So it's definitely, if you're looking to get good use of a free book, if you're signing up, it's definitely a good pick. It's a long book, but it is very well read and just very, very good information. It's again, it's not one of those books that you read and it's where it's designed to make you just hate everything about, eating red meat or chicken or pork or anything.
It's not Upton Sinclair.
No, it's not. It's not The Slaughterhouse. But again, it's sort of peppered with bad pun. It's sprinkled with different ideas about alternate ways that you can be eating and really, really what goes on behind the scenes to get food to your plate.
Well, that's great. We're contemplating a steak dinner for my birthday tomorrow, so I'll have to start listening to it tonight before we launch too far into that. Thank you so much for the recommendation, and thank you so much, Audible, for sponsoring our show. Folks can, in addition to going to audiblepodcast.com/twill and taking advantage of this offer, you can get great information as well as more recommendations from Audible itself on Twitter. Audible_com is who you should follow there. Let's see. Another great big story from this last week had to do with Viacom and YouTube and Google and the lawsuit that has been grinding along for the last 3 years. A whole bunch of documents became public in the summary judgment proceedings. Lots of unpacking of those to do. Ernie, have you taken a look and do you have any initial reactions for our viewers and listeners as to what's going on in that case at this time?
Well, first of all, you all checked me to make sure I understand this correctly, but it sounds like the documents that have been released are the summary judgment motions, the cross motions for summary judgment. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, this is one side versus the other side, and I think one of the accounts said they're basically talking past each other. So for people who aren't lawyers, I guess, what you need to understand about the procedural status of this case is that when people move for summary judgment, what they're saying to the court is, look, we don't need to have a trial because the facts are not the relevant facts, the ones that really matter, are not in dispute. And so you can just apply the law to those facts and we don't have to worry about a big old long trial. So both sides are doing that apparently. But what's funny is they both have, it seems to me, wildly divergent facts. So I guess that bodes ill for the granting of summary judgment, but it certainly is tantalizing and creates a lot of great stuff for journalists to pick through. And, the YouTube account was the one that I guess, got the most press. And that seems to be pretty interesting because they're saying that Viacom knew about, their stuff was up on YouTube and didn't take it down quickly, but in some cases actually put stuff up onto YouTube, and not only just put stuff up, but then had other people put it up so it didn't look like it was coming from Viacom. And this is the part that I find really interesting, if it's true, and that's a big if, this is summary judgment, deliberately roughed up the videos to make them look stolen or leaked. Now, I don't know how they could prove that, but those are the allegations. So, and if that's true, that's, you know, I don't know that that legally torpedoes Viacom's claim, but it certainly makes it look really bad. And the other thing that looks really bad is that Viacom, out of the, somebody help me out with the number of videos, thousands, you know, at issue, 20,000, 30,000, whatever it was.
63,000.
There you go, 63,000, a big number. Out of that big number, like 120 or 130, there's Viacom's now saying, oh, wait, these don't really matter. Let's take those out. And then their explanation is, well, we really wanted to clean up the case. And then somebody astutely points out, well, how much cleaner is the case, or how much more streamlined is if you take out 192 from 60,000? So there's a lot of interesting stuff, but I don't know that there's really, you know, any clear-cut legal opinion that one could render about the merits of either side's case.
Right. It's just another move on the chessboard of this mega infringement case, which, you know, we've talked before about how if the thing actually goes to trial, it'll be a miracle, but it has been 3 years, and neither party certainly is backing down, but who knows what is going on behind the scenes as they attempt to maneuver themselves into some sort of resolution of this gargantuan dispute. I thought a couple of things were interesting. Number one, you just alluded to, Ernie, and that is the dropping of a bunch of videos from the lawsuit last year by Viacom, as Mike Masnick pointed out on TechDirt, because they, you know, his headline here is they still couldn't figure out which clips actually were infringing or not. And his point is, if it takes Viacom 3 years to realize that such videos may or may not infringe, how is it reasonable to expect Google, YouTube to be able to make snap judgments and automatically know what infringes on all the videos uploaded to its site? They also seem to be having a field day with, you know, a la the Grokster case a few years back, with internal emails that acknowledge that there is an infringement problem and discuss it and try and address it, you know, that they're trying to hold up as the smoking gun in this case to say, see, their business was built on this fact that users are using the service to infringe, and without that activity, it would be nowhere near as valuable a site, and thus we can impute liability to YouTube and Google over that. You know, I my take on that is that, you know, if we're going to have a policy that discussions of infringement immediately lead to liability, then we're not going to be able to solve the infringement problem at all. So I'm still going through all the documents. There's tons of coverage, and TechCrunch has a good post where the documents themselves are embedded, if anybody wants to go and slog through them themselves. Venkat, have you checked this out, and do you have any thoughts on
it? I have not read the underlying documents, but I have read a few blog posts, and there are a ton of great blog posts out there summarizing both sides. And one thing that came out, which you alluded to, which is that in the 3 years that this lawsuit has been pending, I think YouTube's non-infringing aspects of YouTube's business model have been vindicated. And I think a comparison to Grokster is very helpful to YouTube, because I think you point to Grokster and everyone said, well, there's not a lot of, you know, non-infringing uses here, but YouTube is, I think, stands as a contrast to that, where there's a lot of legitimate use on YouTube, presidential candidates, you know, releasing statements on YouTube, people creating their own videos, making money on YouTube. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of past infringements that have to be sorted out, but it sounds like going forward, at least, YouTube's business model as a tool that doesn't infringe is will be vindicated ultimately, it seems like.
Yeah, it seems like they're always having, it seems like YouTube is always having issues with copyright infringement, and the issues with the takedown notices coming or going, and how many takedown notices before something is taken down. At the end of the day, when this is settled, who's really going to come out the winner in all this?
Probably the lawyers, I would say.
I didn't want to say that.
and I think that's a fair point, which is I'm really curious to see how much energy and money was spent. I mean, the briefing just looks, I think, useful, obviously, and appropriate, but just, you know, I would imagine hordes of lawyers and everyone else put a lot of energy on both sides into the briefing. So that's a good point, Carl. I think at the end of the day, I'm just curious to see what kind of fees are spent on this dispute.
Oh gosh, I wouldn't even want to be able to guess. I've worked on huge summary judgment motions like this in the past, and you're talking teams on each side of anywhere from 20 to 30 lawyers is probably a conservative guess.
And I think one question is, you know, has Viacom really lost that kind of revenue? I mean, obviously, I think they're bringing the lawsuit to make a point, and there's a lot of principles at stake. But when you really look at the economics of it, I'm curious to see whether, you know, they might get a damage award that's significant based on statutory damages or whatever. But I'm curious as to whether the money they've spent, how that stacks up against the revenue that they've truly lost out of these infringements.
Well, though Viacom continues to aggressively pursue Google and YouTube, they've clarified or responded to the story that we talked about last week regarding their pulling of things from the service Hulu. And there was an article in the Hollywood Reporter that was talking about how Viacom was going to sue bloggers who posted unauthorized Daily Show or Colbert clips. They had a spokesman, Tony Fox, who we talked about last week, made some sort of sweeping comments about how if you use unauthorized clips, doesn't matter. You know, we're not going to get into a fair use analysis or discussion. We're going to go ahead and pursue you. They have tried to do some damage control on that, and someone at Ars Technica, Jackie Chang, reached out to the PR department at Viacom to confirm whether that was true, and they did a complete turnaround and said, no, the headline is completely wrong. We don't intend to pursue bloggers. In fact, fair use works for us. I can't recall a time where we've ever sued a blogger for the use of a Comedy Central clip, and there's no reason to believe that we would do that today. So you can see that the sort of song and dance between whether we're going to acknowledge that fair use exists and is something that people can use to go ahead and cut up and reuse our material, even without our express permission, goes on. And Venkat, have you run across anything like this in your practice? And do you have any thoughts about the state of fair use as we see it in this context?
I have. And I think my view is that generally the takedown system works. And the way it works is, you know, when you run a website, if you receive a takedown notice, you can comply with the notice. When we're talking about user-generated content, third-party content here, and whoever created the content or uploaded the content can come back and say, no, this is non-infringing, or there's a fair use argument. And by and large, in my opinion, that system works. I mean, I think there's oftentimes people don't want to push the envelope, but there's a ton of different outlets out there where you can post your content, and there's a lot of heated argument on both sides. And there was a recent case around the Prince, the dancing baby video, where the EFF won a ruling where the court said, hey, if you wrongfully, you know, tell somebody to take down a video, you could be liable for the attorney's fees caused by the wrongful takedown. And that's kind of at one extreme end of the spectrum. But my view is definitely that the current system works fairly well. I mean, there's robust content out there that's repurposed. You know, there's a lot of mashups and there's a lot of fair use going on. And the DMCA system that we have in place has not really squelched that creativity. So,
well, just as a footnote to that, there's another great post over at Ars Technica, this time by Nate Anderson, saying how they were going to basically walk the walk and talk the talk and acknowledging that there is this thing called fair use. They did an article on various overbroad copyright notices, sort of making fun of folks like the NFL who constantly put out notices that say any unauthorized use for whatever reason, any format is absolutely prohibited. Someone pointed out to Ars Technica, which is owned by Condé Nast Digital, that their own copyright notice was fairly broad in that regard. So they went ahead and altered it. It now says, except where permitted by law, the material on this site may not be reproduced, distributed, et cetera, except with the prior written permission. So acknowledging that there are legal avenues where these kinds of things can take place, even if we haven't expressly said so. Ernie, I thought you might like that one, the nice plain language change to the terms of use.
Yes, I'm always in favor of plain language change. Yeah, I think, well, what was interesting is they're basically just saying that unless it's legally prohibited, this is what we claim. And I guess mm-hmm. that's sort of the Creative Commons approach to say, look, we're not going to try to claim that we own everything. We're going to try to give you fair notice. Although here they're just saying, you know, they're not being as menacing in their claim. And I think that's good. I mean, I think that we, as a whole, I think the legal profession would be served. And I don't think we're going to get that. We're not going to figure this out until we are embarrassed into doing it. But, you know, we're going to be embarrassed into doing it, because anytime a lawyer sends a cease and desist letter and says goofy things, you know, that gets published on the internet. And so, you know, people are starting to figure out that they need to be careful about what they say. I say people, lawyers, I mean. And, you know, it's better that we communicate in clear language and say, this is the right I think I have. Here's from whence it derives. Here's what I think, you know, you shouldn't be doing, rather than having the global, you know, claim of, you know, for all time, in all reaches of the universe, I assert for all time, you know, forever, even after death, you know, these rights. I mean, that kind of stuff just makes lawyers look like, you know, like mafiosi, I guess, you know.
I kind of had a contrarian, slightly contrarian view on that, which is I thought the new disclaimer was superfluous. I mean, why even have it up there? I understand that there are reasons why you want to have a copyright notice, because you want to put people on notice, and then if you sue somebody for infringement, you could show that their infringement was willful. But, you know, to step back and take a practical approach, everyone knows that the content on Ars Technica that they create is owned by them. And, you know, do they really need to tell us that we can use it for fair use? I just thought it was, if they really wanted to be progressive, they could have just said, you know, a lot of other sites have copyright notices and reservation of rights. We don't have one. Everybody knows the lay of the land. It is what it is.
I think what's interesting about this, and you know, you can't help when you're talking about fair use and copyright, I agree completely with what Ernie said, that we're not going to have the real changes that we need on this until we are sort of forced into it. You know, copyright, you know, is so antiquated. Back, what is the Copyright Act of 1780, 1790 or something, when copyright actually first began, and fair use spawning from that, how many years later, much, 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 much later. There still is no clear-cut way for anyone to know what is fair use. I mean, you don't have any objective, real measure of it. My daughter's 11, and her friends, one of their favorite things to do is they make these little music videos, right? And, of course, they post them on YouTube. Every one of them is taking a popular song, and they're playing the song, and they're, you know, adding things and doing things with iMovie, and they're putting up for everybody. It used to be that it would just show up on YouTube, no problem. Then they started uploading them, and they would get an error message, and YouTube would say that they've found in listening to it that there's copyrighted material, please change it. Then that went away. Now it still goes up there completely as they post it, with a little strip on the bottom that says, if you'd like to buy this song, click here. And there's a link where my guess is they have an affiliate set up, you know, with iTunes to purchase the song. It blows me away how instead of taking advantage of the fact that somebody wants to use your content, in which is nothing other than promotion at the end of the day, that there are so many people and organizations that just don't get it, that they're fighting this concept of letting other people promote their material. Saturday Night Live is a great example. Saturday Night Live was dying on the vine years back, and it's, I think, pretty commonly agreed that if it wasn't for people taking clips and putting it on YouTube, that sort of re-sparked this excitement about Saturday Night Live and what they were doing, they wouldn't even be around anymore. When are we actually going to see some type of real change for this, for fair use and for copyright? I don't know. You guys tell me.
Well, I think the story you just told is a nice little, you know, end result of the everything that's gone on in the Google Viacom litigation and all their negotiations with the music labels behind the scenes too, how they're going to address exactly the situation that you described. So it's funny to hear how that has played out for you personally.
But doesn't that make complete sense? If I was a musician, sure, I wouldn't want to see my song being traded for free on Napster like it was for a time, right? But I would love to see that there's a bunch of kids out there sharing videos and they're using my song. Why wouldn't I? And, you know, for lack of better understanding, I can't imagine that it's anything other than, you know, posturing and you know, rattling the saber saying, you know, you can't, this is mine, this is my intellectual property, this is my song, this is mine. And I don't know, at some point, people are going to, you know, these organizations are really going to wake up and realize that it's nothing other than free promotion. I mean, am I missing something? Tell me. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but showing off my stuff and my material, as long as they're not specific, you know, as long as they're not charging for it or trying to take, you know, list it as being theirs or their creation, I can't see how there's anything other than a good, nothing good cannot come out of it.
Yeah, well, you're certainly echoing the opinion of lots of folks out there, at least the ones who are in the Trent Reznor camp of music creators. Of course, then you've got the other side of things who are still clinging to old business models and ideas, and hence we live in the world we live in now where those are still battling it out. Also battling it out, or who has been, John Grisham, I mentioned earlier, bucking the trend. One of the last huge authors to buck the trend of making things available in an ebook format, not for concerns over infringement, I believe, but concerns over what the ebooks are priced at, has reneged, and without putting out any sort of information about it further than his things are now available for formats like the Kindle, has gone ahead and gone back on his concerns about wanting to be paid much more than $9.99 a book and made his works available there. So I guess, Carl, you can feel good that John Grisham has followed your lead and published his ebook in various formats, all its books in ebook.
Have you noticed that what's happened with ebooks on Kindle? And at this point, I still, when I hear ebook, I think Kindle. They're synonymous. I'm sure that's going to be changing over the next few months. But have you noticed that since the Apple iPads announcement for their ebook store and everything that comes from that, the prices of Amazon's ebooks have gone up significantly? And you know, usually when a new competitor comes in, prices go down. But for whatever reason now, if books that used to cost sub $10, you're seeing books on there for $12, $13, $14. I'm not quite sure why. Anyone have any insight on what might have gone on there?
Well, there was the big thing with Macmillan pulling things from Amazon and Amazon pulling out because they didn't want to be bullied as to their pricing strategies. And so I think there is a lot of pressure from publishers themselves on the ebook pricing issue, and that's going to have to play out in the marketplace. I want to go ahead and leave folks with our resource of the week. We were talking about Reuters' policy for online media for their journalists. There is a free conference coming up at Stanford. Let me go ahead and pull up the site so I can give you the date. It's called the Future of Journalism Conference. It's absolutely free. There is a blog at blogs.law.stanford.edu/futureofnews with all the details for attending the conference, which will be at Stanford Law School, 7:30 p.m., Thursday, April 29th. Seating's limited, so if you are in the area and want to join them and hear about the future of journalism, go ahead and go to that site. And I've been to lots of things at Stanford like this, and they do a great, great job. So it's worth bringing to the fore. And I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today on This Week in Law, and thank our panelists. Ernie, thanks so much for being back on the show. Oop, I think you're on mute.
Oh, sorry.
Great. He's just doing some miming.
Yeah, exactly.
I will mime your website address where people can find you, and that is ErnieTheAttorney.net, at Ernie Attorney on Twitter. And Ernie always has great insights both on and off the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Carl, great to have you on. Folks can check out Carl's book at loveyourgeek.com. And you are at Carl Wireless on Twitter.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And Venkat, I've been meaning to have you on the show for some time, so I'm glad we could work that out. Folks can find Venkat at spamnotes.com and V. Balasubramani on Twitter.
Thank you, Denise. I had a good time.
I had a good time, too. And folks, if you want to chat with me between shows, I'm Denise at twit.tv, or you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at dhowell. Love to hear from you. Love to get your feedback and thoughts on the shows. There's always so much to talk about. This week, we didn't get to more than three quarters of our stuff, but there's always next week. We record live at 11 a.m. Pacific time on Fridays. So we will look forward to seeing you then, hopefully, live.twit.tv, which, by the way, is going to work just fine on the iPad when it comes up. Already works well on the iPhone. Without any further work from you, you can tune in on those mobile devices at live.twit.tv. Or, of course, we're available on iTunes as well. So thanks all. We'll see you soon.